show respect for the speaker, as well as those in attendance. We ask that you turn off all cell phones and refrain from getting up during the meeting. It is now my privilege to introduce our main speaker, who comes to us from the Foxhole Group located in Omaha, Nebraska. Please welcome Pat Hinton. Thank you.
was sort of reinforced by the fact that there
was
something wrong with me.
Was what the hell's wrong with you? You know, I mean, but I wasn't going to say that to a lieutenant general or whatever he was at the time. But that's, I grew up, I think that's what we never feel quite right in our heads. And I think that for a long, long time, I really wanted to think that alcoholism, my alcoholism, was just drinking. It was just about drinking. It was just about the amount I drank. But I know now, and I used to, remember that part in the book that says bottles are but a symbol? I used to think, that's not true. You know, I mean, I'd argue with the big book. What the hell's wrong with you? You know, I mean, I really wanted to argue with that. But you know what? It's true. They are. Because there's so far more, so much more depth in the way that we think than in the way that we drink. You know, I mean, I was a weird kid. I thought weird. I reacted weirdly. I was mentally, spiritually, and physically different from the beginning. And I started sipping beer from my dad when he was a skeet shooter. And I started sipping his beer. I'd sit around with the guys and they'd come back from the field, skeet field, and it made my hair curl. It made my boobs grow. I mean, it just was the greatest thing in the world. It was just wonderful. Just that feeling when it just went down and lit up your ribs and hit your stomach and it just boom, you know, it was just terrific. And it just made the world right. It made the whole world right. It let me fit myself into the world. I was always trying to get the world to fit in with me. And it wasn't happening. But when I could, you know, when I drank, that's what it felt like. It just felt like it made me okay, that I was okay. And who is going to, you know, when they had that, it was Betty Ford, I think, I can't remember which one it was, but she said, just say no. Wasn't that Betty Ford? Well, she shouldn't have, huh? Nancy Reagan. Well, I was thinking Betty Ford shouldn't have said that. They have a place out in California named her Betty Ford Rehabilitation Center, I should say. Okay, Nancy Reagan then said, just say no. Well, you know, in my case, why? You know, why would I say no? Why would we say no? Would you have said, well, no? I've had enough. No, oh, no. No, I would say, yeah, give me another one. You give me another one. So, you know, that was, and I loved it. I loved beer. I loved to drink beer. I liked the way it felt, bubbly. And I loved the whole thing. And it made me what I thought everybody else felt like. It made me that way. And so for years and years I did that. And I drank all the way through high school, through college. And along about when I was 25 years old, something happened to me that I hope has happened already to most of you, or all of you, if possible. I was given the greatest gift that probably I have ever been given in my life. It didn't seem like a gift. It doesn't look pretty. It's not a pretty package, certainly. But I was given the gift of desperation. I was just totally desperate. I didn't know what I was done. You know how it just feels, I was done. Oops. I was done. I was totally done. And I started to cry. I was living at the time, it was at Washington, D.C., and I was living in my mom and dad's house in the attic. They had a door that went up to the third floor, which is where my bedroom was, and it had a lock on it. And when I would get out of hand, they would lock the door. And, I mean, these are good people. That's not what they do. But I had a brother and a sister. Neither one of them were alcoholic. They're both, in their own ways, very successful. But when I got out of hand, they locked the door at the bottom of those stairs. And there have been many a time that I would be at the top of those stairs, and I would start to go down, and I would fall, and I'd roll all the way down to the bottom of the stairs. Hit the door and just lay there until they came and got me. And that's not the way they are. But that's the way it was. It was like that. And sometimes I had my dog up there with me. And this particular time, this early in February 1964, it had a big gutter. I had two windows and a big gutter across the five of them. And I had a pigeon there that I had named Herman. And I fed Herman all the time. I'm always feeding animals. Right now I'm feeding them. We have a turkey. We have a lone turkey. We just moved into what is euphemistically called an adult a senior independent living place. It's just like a big apartment. It is a big apartment. And they feed you a couple times a day. And they provide security and all that kind of stuff. It is an assisted living. It's an independent living place. But we moved there after this. When I came out of the coma, I figured I better move someplace. Anyway, so we moved in this place. And I missed my animals because we lived on the edge of a forest where we were. And there were turkeys and foxes and squirrels and raccoons. And I love those. I love to watch them. Because I think they are the purest form of love, watching those wild animals who have, they have nothing. They don't have any access to crying. They don't keep resentments. They're free spirits, and they're beautiful to watch. And I think we don't have any in this place. But we got this turkey. We got one turkey. This is silly to say. Got one turkey. And we named her Sylvia. She's Sylvia. Sylvia's a turkey. She comes across a four-lane highway every day to come over and eat over where our apartment is. And it's in a nice place. There's trees and everything around. And Sylvia the turkey comes over, and I always put down sunflower seeds for it. So I enjoy seeing that. So we do have Sylvia. But at this place, I had this Herman. And at this early days in February 1964, I look out there, and Herman is claws up. I mean, he's dead as a doornail. He's just like this. And my dog died. I mean, it was like a slug from Rascal Flatts or something. My dog died. The pigeon died. The booze wasn't working anymore. My parents were on to me. I had a hiding place for the empties. It was an old cardboard wardrobe where, when you move, you move a lot. You have these wardrobes you hang your clothes in. Well, I put the empties at the bottom of the cardboard wardrobe, and my mother discovered that there were 22 empties at the bottom of this thing. And so she rattled it I've discovered you, and that happened that week. And I just was desperate, and I started to cry. And she heard me crying when she came up, and I said, I'm an alcoholic and I need some help. I mean, it was that simple and yet that profound. I couldn't do it anymore. And she got all happy and got everything together and wedged me into the back of my dad's Porsche automobile and took me out the country and unfolded me on the porch of this place where I dried out. And it was in Melwood Farm. It was a farm at that time. Now a big housing development outside of Washington. And I got sober. They dragged me out. And, you know, I was really grateful that I was able to be in a place like that and to be able to give, to be given that time to sort of get all, or not all the blues, because it takes a year to get all the vestiges of alcohol out of your system, at least. And so that's why it's kind of hard around the year, because you're really, at that point, you're really kind of sober. And, you know, the reality is there. It's, you know, you haven't got anything left in your system. But anyway, I got sober and I started. They took us to meetings. They took us out in the little buses. We were some of the original little bus people. They loaded us up in the buses and took us to some meetings in Washington, D.C. And I, you know, I didn't really want to be an alcoholic. I mean, who wants to say, oh, well, I'm an alcoholic? Oh, happy joyous. You know, I wasn't like that. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to be ordinary. I wanted to be normal. I wanted to be average, but I wasn't. And I'm so glad I didn't get what I wanted, because I have a wonderful life. I don't think I could have had this life if it hadn't been for the fact that I got so bad and surrendered and just, you know, surrendered to everything. And so I started going to meetings. When I got home, I lived not far from the meetings there, and I would take the bus up to the meetings, and I would walk sometimes when it was nice, and I went to the Friendship Group on the grounds of the Washington Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and I walked in, and somebody welcomed me. And I don't think there's anything any more important in a meeting than people who greet, who are standing at the door and shaking hands and welcoming you to the group. Because, you know, I didn't feel welcome almost anywhere. And to actually have somebody stand there and welcome you to the group, I think it's just one of the most important things that you can do as a member of this group. And Mike was at the door when we pulled up, and it was so, and another kid was there, and, you know, it was so good to see that. And there are many places, and I have been to meetings all over the country, all over the world, really, and there are many places where if I had been new, I would have died, because there are no people there, they don't greet you, they act like, I mean, they don't even talk to you. It's just like you sit down and the meeting starts. And it just isn't, you know, we, especially when we're new, but even when we're not, when we have had really bad times, we need, euphemistically, the arms of AA to be around us. And for that, we need people just to look like they're glad we're there and welcome us in that way, whether they say, oh, we're glad you're here, or whatever. It's important. It's really important. Because no matter how sober you get, no matter how long you've been here, you know, we need to have that feeling. We need to be needed, I guess, or comforted, in order for us to feel okay some days. And I'm not suggesting that we're some kind of neurotic. We are neurotic, but nonetheless, I mean, that's the least of our troubles, I think, is if we're neurotic. But I think just the fact that people welcome you and make you feel that way, it's good. I want it to be my groups, to be enthusiastic groups, which express the power of God, really, through laughter and shaking hands and clapping. I mean, I'm big on clapping. And, tell a good job or whatever, thanking the speakers afterwards, although that seems self-serving right now. But I think it's important to thank the speakers afterwards, not necessarily for the speaker, but for you, to thank the speaker, because I think it's polite. You know, they've come and done their thing, and, you know, sometimes they're, you know, I have sat through some speakers that I thought were never going to shut up, you know, because it was just a long, hard, rocky road that they had to tell. But by gosh, they tried. they did the best they could, and I could thank them for that, you know. I was telling everybody around the table the story about when I went to Waco one time, and they had invited this guy here from Texas who was an American Airlines pilot, and he used to do big book studies, and I mean, he used to talk all over the place, and it turns out he'd been drinking off and on for years and years. And so, before I went down there, my husband had gotten somebody sent him a copy of an arrest report where this guy had been picked up for drunk driving, like Monday, and he was on the program in Waco where I was going. And so, when we got there, the committee called us. Bob Vance and I called us and said, "What do we do? This guy, he told us he's been drinking. And he scheduled to speak on Saturday night. What do we do?" And, of course, the Vance went crazy. He's ADHD anyway, and he just was crazy. He was just rocking and jumping, and oh, it was just terrible. And we have both said, in other words, no, he shouldn't speak. And they had him speak anyway. And I think to when you speak, you should have, it's a privilege. And it's a privilege that you earn by being sober. So no matter what that person is saying, no matter whether their talk is good or bad, it's a privilege for them to talk. And it gives them the opportunity to try to, you know, tell everybody how things are in their life. And, you know, here's this guy. He's getting up there and talking. And he said, "Well, I drank Monday, but I was depressed, and my friend got killed in a car wreck, and I was depressed." Well, you know, can it, Budros? You know, it was ridiculous. And so they moved him at least from Saturday night to Saturday morning. They buried him on Saturday morning, but there were still people there, and Bob was going crazy, you know, rocking like I was upstairs the chair over. And he said he wasn't even going. I said, I've been sober longer than you, so you're going because I'm going, so you got to go. We went, and afterwards I just said to the guy, "You shouldn't talk. This is going to kill you." And 3 weeks later, it did. Because he kept drinking, had surgery, had a convulsion, went off the operating table and pulled all the tubes out and exsanguinated on the operating room floor. I mean, that's what happens when you drink and don't tell people. He died. Sorry, but that's the way it was. But, so if you have, you know, thank the speaker. That's one of the things that I always try to do is thank the speaker. But anyway, I just told him, "You shouldn't speak. It's going to kill you." Well, it did. Anyway, so, you know, as I stayed sober, I met a guy at an eating meeting, very much like this, at the St. Albans Church. We used to, the group that I went to, which was the friendship group, we had a quarterly meeting like this with food. That was always, it's always popular when you have food. And this guy was in line with Buck Doyle, who was a big guy. He was a big sponsor in Washington, D.C. And he said, "Have you seen that Piggy girl?" And Buck said, "Yeah, she's here. She's serving the potato salad." So Nick got in line, came up, and I gave him some potato salad. He said, "You want to go for coffee afterwards?" And I said, "Sure." We went for coffee, and we got married 2 months later, which my sponsor was out of town. And so was his, actually. His sponsor was a flying tiger. You remember the flying tiger? Some of you are old enough to remember that. He was a flying tiger, and they were having their convention, and he was at the convention, so we took that opportunity to get married, and we're still married 48 years, and it's worked well. I don't It's lots of happy, that's lots of me. I had an interesting thing happen lately, and I want to talk about this a little bit also. I had a sponsor. My first sponsor was a woman named Jane Holler, and she walked up to me, really, and said, I'll be your sponsor. You look new. And you know how we look. We look like dogs on the freeway. You know, we're just... Nothing. I mean, you hear somebody slam. I'm sorry. I don't mean to pick on the new people, but, you know, a door slamming two blocks away will give us a fright. You know, we... Oh. I mean, I was just very nervous. And she said... I thought I got dressed up, but I had on a blue turtleneck sweater and gray stretch pants because they were the only pants I had that would expand and contract with however I was in girth, because when I drank, I didn't eat because it took the buzz off, and so I would get skinny, and then I would have a period of sobriety, and I'd eat like crazy and get fat, and you know, so I was wearing those, and I had something orange that spilled down the front of it, which I couldn't get out. But it was the only sweater that I had, really, because when you're buying alcohol, you don't buy clothes. And so I couldn't get this out, and this is my hair. Oh, God, my hair. When you drink, alcohol goes into your system, and it goes all through your body, but it goes to your brain. And what it does in your brain is there's a whole bunch of these little things called synapses that wiggle like this. They are always wiggling. They're wiggling now in your head. Millions of them. They just wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. And then there's a thing called the neurons are the little things like this. And the synapse are where it jumps across. There's just a little electrical thing, a spark. And these things that tickle, tickle like this, and they go spark and spark. Well, when you drink, these things don't like it. And remember, there's millions of them. And that you drink, goes in, but gets here to the wigglies, and they're like this, and it goes. And so when the spark goes, it goes. And it just like gets the ends of these things and fries them. And so you... When they say you got a fried brain, remember the fried brain? You do. I mean, you literally have a fried brain from these things. So, if your brain gets like that, just think about your hair. My hair had somewhere died. I mean, it was just the worst looking. It looked like a haystack. It looked like somebody stuck a bunch of hay on top of my head. It was just awful. I mean, it was... And it itched. My head itched because I had all this hay growing out of it, you know. So I'd walk around with scratching. I'd scratch my head. And I had a big hole, and I'd scratched in my hair up here. It was a big hole. And that's the way I came to AA. You know, that's what I looked like. A blue sweater with orange on it, you know, haystack head. Scratched hand, you know. I mean, I literally was like that. When this woman walked up to me and said, I'll be your sponsor, I didn't know what that was. I had no clue. So I said, okay. Okay. Because, okay, you know. And so I just hung around. I just hung on her. Like, you know how kids are, they hang on you all the time when they're little. I hung on her. I just hung. Hugged on her sleeve. I sat next to her. I followed her around. And she scared me. You know, she had like really crimped hair. You know, in those days when they used those crimpers and they crimped her hair. It was silver. And she looked like a bullet head. You know, she was just, she'd just lower her head and ran me or something. I didn't know. But I followed her. And of course, as time went by, I grew to have a lot of respect for her. And to care about what happened to her. And just before we moved from Washington, D.C., she died. And so when I moved from Washington to Nebraska in 1975, I got Jean Mowry, her sponsor. And she was my sponsor until she died, which was when she had 40 years of sobriety. And then I had to look for somebody. And the sad thing was, and this is what I want to put in a plug for their good number of women here. Thank you for coming. And thank you for all you guys who came. And I get to see Matt, which is totally a surprise. He's from California. He was here on business, and he got to come tonight. That's terrific. And Joe, and of course, just tons of Orion. It's great. Anyway, what was I saying? I forgot where I was. I got so carried away with myself. What? Oh, yes, that's what I was going to talk about. When I started to look for a sponsor, I had been sober 40-some years, maybe 41 years, because my sponsor was sober a year longer than I was. But at least she was sober longer than I was. And I have my arrogance is such that I need somebody who's going to say to me, there's got to be somebody who's sober longer than me. Because I would say, well, that's what I would have thought. I'd take a problem to her, and I'd think, well, that's what I would have thought when I was sober that long. But now I'm sober 42 years, and it's not the same anymore. I know myself. I know that much. And so I knew I had to get somebody longer. I could not find a woman active in Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere in the country who was sober longer than me and still active in AA. That's terrible. That's terrible. So that's why I'm saying to you women, please stick around, because some old biddy like me is going to sometime need a sponsor. And it's good. I mean, I want you here. There's plenty of men. But I never believed in men sponsoring women or women sponsoring men. I don't believe in it. And so I looked all over. I looked everywhere. I talked to people when I go on conferences and stuff. Nobody. So finally, I asked Clancy to sponsor me because there wasn't anybody else that I could think of. And he had always been a friend. He had sponsored my husband for years. He did a good job with that, so I didn't have to. And, so I asked him, and I haven't regretted it. Now, I haven't had him that long. I mean, I've had him for about 6 months or so because I had to look. But I call him every week, and I report in because I have to be accountable to somebody. And I believe we all need to be accountable. And that's one of the good things about a group like this. And this is a similar group to Foxhall, to the Pacific group. They're similar in their structures. And they're similar in the fact that the people who go to these groups have one thing in common, usually. And that is they're bad alcoholics. They're bad alcoholics. We're bad alcoholics. And, you know, you said, well, everybody's, all alcoholics are bad. No, they're not. There are some pretty weedy alcoholics. I mean, they don't drink like I drank. I drank till you had to hit the last drop by warming the bottle with your hands to get it to roll down and onto your tongue. That's my kind of alcoholic. You know, just to get just that much. I'm a bad alcoholic. I got a bad brain. I mean, it's, let me tell you a story. I got a ton of stories. I don't even know when I started. When did I start? Oh, please don't let me go over what I'm supposed to. Anyway, this has to do really with primary purpose. Okay, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings in the audience. But on the other hand, I don't really care. I mean, I really don't. But I was invited to speak at this goofy, goofy women's retreat. Oh, it was the goofiest, goofiest thing I ever heard of in my life. I'm not even going to identify the state. That's how bad it was. I mean, it was bad. And I went down there, and I was the token AA. And Nell Argent, who is a well-known member from Oklahoma, was the token ally. But everybody else had some isms I had never even heard of, never even thought about. I mean, they had everything. Multiple personalities. Sex addicts. You just name it. Masturbators Anonymous. I mean, they had everything. It was really sorry. But there's no little old ladies in the audience here. If you have a child, it don't knock it, you know. Anyway, there were all these different isms. So, we're at this. They have it. So, you know, when you're kind of want, you have to kind of join in, you know. So, I went to one of these old, this group thing. I was talking to Aaron's mother about this, Diane. I was talking to her about it. It was a group where you have this circle on the outside of women, and then they have a circle on the inside. And the circle on the inside goes one way, the circle on the outside goes another, and they play music. And then when they ring a bell, they stop. And the people who are on the inside have their eyes closed, and the people on the outside have their eyes open. And so when you are in front of the person, when there's a bell rings, you have to say to them some affirmative thing. The first affirmative thing that you can think of. Well, the woman that was in front of me, all I could think about was what my grandpa said one time. He said, "Must be nice to be able to eat grass through a picket fence." She had six buck teeth. Think of, and I'm like frozen. So finally, I just said, "You're brave to be here." And I quit participating in it. I just left out of the van. I just left. So then I went by, Mel was with me. I went by the they had a t-shirt tent where you were supposed to do anything you wanted on a t-shirt, anything. Well, I'm an artist, but I'm not a crafty person. I don't do crafts. Not anything against crafts, I just don't do them. And everybody got this t-shirt, so I threw paint at it like Chagall, you know, sprinkled it with glitter. And I was standing back looking at my effort, and this woman came up and said, "What are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "Well, I'm a multiple personality." Well, my first thought was, "Well, which one are you today, right now? Somebody who doesn't like art, maybe? You know, something like that." I mean, it was just scary. And I could not get to the airport soon enough. And here was the reason. Saturday night of this thing, they had us in a barn. And you know how they have halos, a haylofts around the outside, you know, inside of the barn. And it was hotter than the hinges. It was so hot. I had on shorts. And everybody got a candle with a little thing around it. It was supposed to be a, I don't know what they call those things, but they're little pieces of paper. Actually, what they were was a coffee filter. And somebody shoved a candle through it. And you lit the candle, and then you carry, this is a meditation thing. You were meditating. Well, they were meditating, taking somebody back through their life. Well, I knew what they were doing. I mean, I'm no dummy. I knew that they were taking some poor woman back to some terrible event that happened to her in the old days. And here's how, this was supposed to be a spiritual retreat. It's supposed to be spiritual. I I'm thinking, first of all, I'm getting wax all over myself. It's dripping on me. It's on the floor. It's on my knees. It's hot. I'm thinking, this is the worst thing I've ever been to in my life. These people are irresponsible. I mean, I was having terrible thoughts. And I thought, something that cheered me up was I could get an Uzi. And I could go up in the loft and mow them all down. Now, that's what happens to me when I get into a place where there is no singleness of purpose. Because we have here, our singleness of purpose is that we're alcoholics and we help alcoholics. And when we help alcoholics, we get better. When you put us in with a bunch of people like that, we get out our Uzis. Which is why we try to keep this to singleness of purpose. That's why we don't care if you have an addiction of another sort. But when you're here, please just be an alcoholic. Here in the room. So Peggy Martin doesn't start thinking about shooting all the people now. So I have some kind of spiritual rest. It's not about us wanting you to make yourself different and out of here. That's not the point. The point is, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're alcoholics here. We have a lot of other problems. I'm a football nut. I mean, you can accuse me of being somewhat passionate about football, because I am. I could have footballitis or something, but I don't talk about the crazy stuff I've done in terms of football in a meeting. Well, I might, but I mean, it would be a side note in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. But we talk about alcoholism here. We talk about our alcoholism. So that the person who's coming in the door who has that same thing can relate to us and can feel, if not as though they're home, at least as though they're comfortable and they belong there. Because that's what we need to know. We need to know that we belong somewhere and that it's okay for us to be there. And it's just lately, it's come to my attention that this singleness of purpose and this business of, if you're in our group, and I think Mike and Mike can both tell you this, if you're in our group, that you have your primary disease, and you use that, your primary disease. There's a lot of us that have a lot of other things, too, but we don't bring them up there, because that's not our purpose. That is not our single desert purpose. And so, anyway, but one of the things that I thought about, and this is so true, I told you at the beginning that my drinking was bad, that my thinking was worse. This came up out of my murk of a brain just recently, and I heard it years ago. The monkey is off my back, but the circus is still in town. And that's what it is for us. The monkey's off our back. We're sober. But the circus is still in town. And that's what we need Alcoholics Anonymous for. That's why we help one another. The single most powerful thing that I can do is to help another alcoholic. The single most powerful thing is to stick out my hand and help another alcoholic. To be a sponsor. To sponsor people. There's nothing like the privilege that there is. Erin calls me every week. And I can guarantee that she's going to call me every week. And I talk to her every week. Except when I was in a coma. I said I was on vacation. That's why I refer to it as my vacation. But anyway, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like being at a beginner's meeting. If nothing else, go to a beginner's meeting or lead a beginner's meeting. We have beginner's meetings. I know you have them here. Go be lead at the beginner's meeting. Look at people. Look them in the eye and see the dog on the freeway. There's nothing like it. I love to sit down next to somebody who's been drinking. I just like perfume. You know, just, oh boy, that's what it was like, all right, you know. It just, because it takes me back to those days when I was new and I really was desperate and I really needed help. That's, I want that feeling to remain with me. I want to know what it's like. I want to remember it because my life is so good. You know, my life is good. We're, my husband and I owned a business, and we sold it, and we sold our house, and we've sold our building, and we're going to close on the building at the end of the month, and we're living in this independent living community, and it's great. And, you know, there's something about being in a Pullman, being, I assume they said I was near death. Now, there's something about that that when we, if we recover from that, that nothing is any big deal. Well, that should be applied to alcoholism, too. The only difference is that we have this, like, brain that wants to kill us. You know, it's a bad neighborhood. I've heard it described as a bad neighborhood. And it's out to kill us. Because we just love to think. There's nothing we like better than just to think. And, I mean, I can burn the midnight oil thinking, you know, just thinking about some resentment or something that's really useful thinking, too. But, you know, it just, you know, we need each other, and we need the groups, and we need to keep active. And it's the least that I can do. For heaven's sakes, it's the least that I can do. Because the circus is still in town. I mean, it's still, I'm still an alcoholic. I'm not ever going to be not an alcoholic. And one of the problems, one of the girls that used to be involved in this group has gone. And if she isn't drinking, and I think she is, but if she isn't drinking, within 2 years, she probably will be, because that's about average. And then what do we have then? We have a head full of AA and a body full of booze. And there is no place that is worse to be than that. A head full of AA. A head full of the friends. A head full of the kindnesses that have been done. The coffees that have been given in our honor. Or that we have given for people for their birthdays. Because we have coffees on Friday nights for people who have birthdays. You know, those are the sorts of things that if we go back to drinking again, and many of you will, it's a sad thing to say, but that's the way it is. Because the circus is still in town. And the funny man is telling you, you know, go drink again. It couldn't have been that bad. It wasn't that bad. I mean, I just think it was that bad. But it wasn't that bad. But that's the service. You're telling you what to do. And many people listen to it. About 5 out of 6 alcoholics will die drunk. That's sad. That's a lot of people. And I don't really want to be one of them. I want to stay here. You know, I had the privilege of taking care of my parents in the last days of their lives. And I absolutely adored my parents. They really did. And for some reason or other, I've been thinking about my dad a lot lately. And I don't know why that is. Well, I do know why that. Because he died on March the 15th. And that was just 2 weeks ago or so. Well, a month ago. So I've been thinking about him for the last month or so. And, you know, I always absolutely wanted to please him. I really did. He was an engineer and a physician. He was a little kid from Pacific, Missouri. And he got a scholarship to Washington University and then went on to med school from there. And he joined the Air Force during the war. And he went over and served in served in Okinawa, and he served, you know, and he stayed in the Air Force until he retired when he was a lieutenant general. Then he went to work for Mitchell Omaha, and he worked for Mitchell until he was 80-something. maybe 2 or maybe 3. And he retired because he said he wanted to get a little rest before he died. And he had a great sense of humor. And he, you know how you sort of know when you're a favorite. And my brother was my mother's favorite. And my sister and I were equally favorites of my dad. And he was proud of me. And he was proud of me because I got sober. And for all those years, I mean, they didn't sometimes know where I was. They didn't know I was coming home. I just, now, knowing that, having a kid who's in AA for 20-some years now, I know what it was like to wait at night and not know whether they were coming home or not, or if they were still alive. And so when I got sober, of course, I, for the rest of their lives, I made it up to them. I should have. It should have been me. And I got to take care of them. And towards the end, I know he had gotten very frail. And we'd given him a blanket, and I covered him over with the blanket. And he just reached out and gave me just a huge hug. And that was not like him. He didn't usually do that sort of thing. But it just, you know, it just was an amazing relationship that I had with him. And I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do that. And the reason I say that is because my brother, on the other hand, had many resentments towards my father, some of them justified. But he never got to make amends to him. He never got to see him or make amends to him before he died. And now he has to live with that. And I see him having to live with that. So if you have an amend that needs to be made, or if you have some correction that needs to be done, I suggest that you get it done, because you never know. You don't know. Johnny always thought, well, I'll just do it the next time I come out. But he just never came out, and he never came out. And then Dad died, and he didn't get a chance to do anything about it. And my little mother had Alzheimer's, but fortunately she was the type who, she was funny. She was very funny. And so we didn't have any clashes in that sense. And so I got to brush her hair for her right before she died. It was really cool. She had gorgeous hair. God, I wish I had her hair. She just had gorgeous hair right to the time she died. Just dark and hardly any gray in it, and she was 96. But I got to take care of them, and I got to make amends to them, and I got to do the right thing by them, and I am so grateful for that. And it reminds me, since there's a guy who's got a great fox tie over here, it reminds me of the story that I tell about the fox, and I haven't told it in a long time, but I used to take the dogs for a walk. Biggie and I would take the dogs for a walk. And we used to feed some foxes. And we would dump leftover food or Chinese food. They like Chinese food. We'd dump it at the bottom of this tree down in the park down from our house. And we would dump it on the ground and say, "Here's your breakfast, foxies." And they had a den right underneath this tree. So they would come up around the tree as soon as we got back a few feet or a few yards with the dogs. They'd come up and start eating. Well, this one particular time, Dick was out of town, and it was really cold. It was like 30, it was really cold, like 39 below or something. It was terrible. And I had on my down coat, and one of our dogs was Cuckoo, and she had on a little pink coat. You know, I was walking the two of them, Charlie and Cuckoo. And, put out the food and dumped it, and I turned around to leave, and I felt something. I mean, I felt something. And I looked over my shoulder, and it was the fox, and it was closer to me than from the castle here. It was that close. I mean, it was really close. And as I watched, he sat down, and then he laid was saying thank you. I really think this fox was saying thank you for feeding us, thank you for putting the food out for me and my babies. And I don't know if that's really true, but I choose to think it is. And as such, that's why I think about myself. It's kind of my token, my totem, as the Indians say, is a fox. Why foxhole is foxhole? Because it was at the corner of Foxhole and Reservoir Road, but also because of the fox. And I like the fox. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for everything that you've done for me. Thank you for being there when I couldn't even, when I was in a coma, for God's sake. You know, thank you for doing that, for taking over, for arranging people to call different people and stuff while I couldn't take the phone calls. And thank you for greeting, and thank you for picking up the torch, because, you know, I'm 75 years old, and that's not terribly old, really, not in my family. But I think I've been rode hard and put up wet. So I've had a hard couple of years. And use a little horse term there. That was one of the things that was always sad for me because I can't ride horses anymore, and I love to ride horses. But anyway, you know, I want to thank you just for being there for me. Always. Always and ever. And that's why I want you guys to stick around. That's why, a lot of why I have, not only for myself, but also because I don't want to, I want somebody to always be there for me. And so I want to try to be at the door for you for as long as I possibly can. I want to be there at the door so you can have a welcome when you come in. Because someday, I can't be at the door anymore. And you got to be there. So you got to stay here. And you got to take on the mantle. Stand by the door. And get people in here. And say, welcome to the Chicago group. We're glad